This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Book 3 of the Draconis Memoria, The Empire of Ashes, by Anthony Ryan. Read for you by Steve West. 1. The Artisan's Shadow. From the Journal of Miss Luella Tithencroft, Sonora, 27th Termester, 1600. Company year, 211. I awoke from another dream of Corrick, as is my wont most mornings in these troubled times. If, as the infrequent responses to my many letters to the Maritime Protectorate insist, Lieutenant Corrick Hylemore is most likely dead, as opposed to merely missing, he appears to have left behind a very busy ghost. My humour is misplaced, I know. Cruel, even. To myself, if not the memory of the man I loved. Still love. At least be honest with yourself, Luella. But I find it preferable to the weeping and mewling expected of my sex. The dream was different again. My erstwhile fiancé's nightly visits are rich in variety, if not clarity. I would dream of him before, of course, especially during those long, awful months of separation, thanks to his slavish service to our corporate overlords. Even more so during the unjust Dalcyon slaughter the Syndicate chooses to call an emergency. But those dreams were more like memories, my mind seeking his company in somnolence when it was denied me in the waking hours. Walks in the park, stolen hours of intimacy away from my parents' ever-prying gaze. How many, many wonderful arguments. I used to cherish my dreams of him, but now I dread them, for I always find him in danger. This time he was somewhere cold and very far away. The images are always vague, but his face remains clear, and just lately it is the face of a man troubled by a terrible weight of guilt. Corrick is not a man given to excessive introspection, but, despite his professional calling, he does have a greater capacity for feeling than many might imagine. There I go again, the present tense. But, like my misplaced humour, I find I can't help it. In my soul, if not my mind, I know him to be alive, and somewhere very cold. I endured another breakfast with mother and father, he hiding behind his copy of the Intelligencer, as per usual, whilst she filled the silence with inane gossip. Just lately, as the news from home and abroad grows ever worse, I have noticed a certain desperation in her chatter. Her myriad tales of petty scandal, announced engagements, and barbed comments regarding my own singular lack of prospects in that regard, are spoken with a somewhat shrill note and an overbright cast to her eyes. At times I think she is trying to weave some form of magic spell, as if this verbal frippery will banish the encroaching threat through dint of sheer, mundane normalcy. But the threat is real, and shows no sign of abating. Veros falls silent, proclaims the Intelligencer in characteristically bald terms. As yet, however, the reason for the city's silence remains unexplained, if much speculated upon. The interior pages relate more lurid details of the latest Corventine revolution, this one apparently successful. Entire Corvus aristocracy slaughtered in a single night. Mock trials see hundreds hanged. Self-proclaimed ruling council led by notorious criminal dictatress. And so on. Many of my voterist friends insist these stories are lies, concocted by the corporate-controlled press to stoke fear of just rebellion. Personally, I am not so certain all these horrors are in fact imaginary. The Corventine people suffered centuries of cruel oppression at the hands of a hideous, blood-soaked Rainyaki. Is it so surprising they would act with a vengeful heart now? Other stories speak of riots in many North Mandanorian towns, an increased desertion rate amongst Protectorate soldiery, and, perhaps most worrying of all, a collapse in the corporate bond and share markets. I noticed Father's hands take on a small tremor as he turned the page to this particular report, causing me to ponder just how much of the family wealth he has invested in market speculation over the years. But of course, any question I might raise in regard to financial matters would be met with either cold indifference or a suggestion that, if business interests me so much, I should give up my radical hobbies and find corporate employment. So I said nothing, washed my toast and boiled egg down with a gulp of tea, kissed Mother on the cheek, and set off for the offices of the Voters' Gazette. As has become somewhat routine, the morning editorial meeting soon degenerated into a political discussion, and thence a full-blown shouting match. Mr. Mantelprop, the photostatist, nearly came to blows with Mr. Mityard, the foreign affairs correspondent, over the latter's blatant bias in favour of vindictive beastliness in his reporting of the Corvantine Revolution. Lately, in my capacity as acting editor-in-chief, I have been sorely tempted to simply dismiss every correspondent on the staff. Given that I write at least two-thirds of the words in every issue, whilst my supposed subordinates spend their hours in fruitless argument, it would hardly be a greater burden to run the paper as a solo enterprise. It would also make for a much more peaceful working environment. But as this periodical, being the official organ of the Voters' Rights Alliance, was constituted as a cooperative rather than a private entity, I lack the power to dismiss anyone without a majority vote of the editorial board. I would normally have made efforts to calm the atmosphere and force some semblance of order on the meeting, but today found myself too wearied by my troubled sleep. So instead I took my notepad and pen and set off for the Dockside district, leaving my colleagues to their strife. Any experienced correspondent will know that the docks are always a useful source of information, most particularly during troubled times. Sailors from all corners of the globe can be found in any dockside tavern, and they are ever a talkative breed, especially when encouraged by a young and not unattractive woman, willing to spend a few scrip on a round of ale or two. Today, however, it transpired that such machinations would not be necessary, for I found the docks in a state of considerable excitement. Several weeks before, the so-called Blessed Demon had forsaken her reign of terror in the marsh world to inflict fiery destruction on the Dockside district before mysteriously vanishing. The damage has been only partially repaired, and many warehouses remain in a blackened and ruined state. However, syndicate authorities were efficient in restoring the cranes to the wharf and rebuilding the many wooden jetties which had been burned down to the waterline. I found the quayside athrong with protectorate soldiers and constabulary, several senior officers amongst them. Beyond the broad waters of the harbour itself, I could see smoke pluming from the great engines that operate the huge doors in the guard wall. Usually only one door is raised after the morning tide, but today all three doors were being drawn up at once. Naturally, my questioning of the protectorate officers on the scene produced either a bland but polite no comment or a frosty suggestion that I seek grist for my voterist propaganda elsewhere. Consequently, I was compelled to elicit information from a more willing source, albeit reluctantly. I found Sigmund Talwick midway along the wharf, his lanky, poorly tailored form perched on a crate as he scribbled in his notepad. "Miss Tithencroft," he said upon noting my approach. His broad smile would have been taken for warm and welcoming, if not for the poorly concealed carnal interest he simultaneously displayed in surveying my person. "How are things at the Gazette? I hear your circulation is booming, almost breaking four figures last month." "Five figures," I lied, as I often do in Mr. Talwick's presence, and find it scarcely tweaks my conscience at all. "I must congratulate you on the Intelligencer's latest issue," I went on. "For a periodical given to vulgar and tasteless reporting, your paper truly outdid itself today. Corvantine rebels are roasting and eating aristocratic babies, apparently." He stiffened a little, his smile fading. "I am merely a correspondent, miss, not the editor." "Quite so, sir," I turned and nodded at the rising harbour doors. Might I inquire if any of your protectorate friends have enlightened you as to the meaning of all this? No, he replied somewhat archly. They haven't, but one doesn't raise all three doors for a single ship, does one? A fleet, then, and not composed of enemies. So it seems, but from where does it hail is the question. Care for a wager, Miss Tythoncroft? My money's on a flotilla of Dalcian mercenaries, hired by the Protectorate to augment the Northern Fleet. I leave the financial speculation to my father, sir. However, I doubt the Protectorate could find many Dalcians willing to take their scrip after the emergency. Verestians, then. In the pre-colonial era, they'd fight for anyone if the price was right. Just then the harbour doors reached their full elevation, as signalled by the chorus of steam whistles that sounded from the top of the wall. A short while later the dark, slow-moving shape of a vessel appeared in the central entry point to Sonora Harbour. I immediately recognised it as a small steam ferry, the type normally employed in carrying passengers around coastal regions. However, from its appearance, it seemed to have been at sea for many days. The vessel's paintwork was besmirched with soot, and her paddles were missing some blades, making only partial purchase on the water as she moved sluggishly to one of the nearby jetties. Mr. Talwick and I quickly made our way to the jetty, as lines were thrown between ship and shore. I could see a large crowd of people on the ferry's foredeck, mostly women and children, and all possessed of the kind of grey-faced silence that comes from prolonged privation. As we drew nearer, I could see many weeping, either in relief or sorrow. I couldn't tell. A fleet, to be sure, Talbic commented, jerking his chin at the opened portals, through which several more similarly bedraggled vessels were making their way. But composed of refugees, not mercenaries. We were close enough to make out the lettering on the ferry's hull. IRV Communicant, Registered Pharos Harbour, 03/06/177. Sailed all the way from the Tyrell Islands in a 30-year-old coast runner, Talwick said with a note of admiration. A gangway had been manoeuvred into place, and people were disembarking the ferry, most moving with a stooped, unsteady gait that bespoke near exhaustion. Some of the older passengers were being aided by their younger compatriots, and many were still weeping. As they began to congregate on the quayside, my gaze was drawn to a particular figure who stood straighter than the rest. She was a tall woman of South Mandanorian colouring, and, from the way the other refugees responded to her, seemed to enjoy some form of authority. Joya, she called to a slender girl, who, along with a pale-skinned woman wearing oddly garish face paint, was helping a man with bandaged eyes navigate his way down the gangplank. Bring him here. We need to keep all the patients together. Molly, when you've settled Mr. Adaman, get yourself back aboard and retrieve all the medicines you can find. Ain't rightly sure how generous our hosts are gonna be. Good day, madam. Talwick, always possessed of a keen eye for the best source of information, walked up and greeted the tall woman with a bow. Sigmund Talwick, chief correspondent of the Sonora Intelligencer. Might I inquire as to your name? Surely, the woman replied, moving away. It's Mrs. Mind Your Own Seer Damn Business. Talwick straightened with an aggrieved sniff, but, never one to be distracted in his quest for a story, immediately began questioning the other refugees. I, however, felt there was more to be had from Mrs. Mind Your Own Seer Damn Business, and pursued her through the crowd for several minutes, until she consented to notice my presence. You another correspondent? She asked, glancing up from inspecting a wound on a child's arm. The infant seemed to have lost the energy to cry, merely sitting quietly in her mother's lap and gazing at the stitched red and blue mark in her flesh with wide, incurious eyes. Of a sort, I replied. I represent the Voters' Rights Alliance. I looked around at the growing throng of beggared people, finding I had to cough away the sudden catch in my throat. I assure you I only want to help. Good. She tied a fresh bandage around the girl's arm, then tweaked her small chin. The girl merely blinked and settled deeper into her mother's arms. These people need medical care, the woman went on, rising and turning to me. And those on the other ships will need places to live and food to eat. Can your alliance help with that? Yes, I said, possessed of a sudden conviction. I'll return forthwith to our offices and start organizing a relief effort. I extended my hand. Miss Luella Tythencroft. Mrs. Fredabel Torcreek. We shook, and a faint, grim smile played on her lips, presumably as she read the feelings evident in my features. Guess this is a new sight for you, hun. Yes. I coughed again, standing straighter. Please, before I go, you were at Pharos, yes? That's right. And it's gone. Drake and Spoiled came out of the sea and sky and took it, doing a whole lot of killing in the process. Us former Carvenporters and a few others managed to get away, but we left a good many folks behind. I have a friend, I began, hating myself for the way my words stumbled from a faltering mouth. My former fiancé, in fact, a Lieutenant Heilmore. He's been posted as missing, presumed dead. I wondered... Heilmore? Mrs. Torcreek stared at me for a moment, then let out a laugh. Firstly, I believe it's Captain Heilmore these days. And he ain't dead, hun. Last I heard, he's very much alive. Though he's probably freezing his ass off alongside my kin just now. Chapter 1. Clay. It was like drinking liquid fire, the heart blood sending a searing bolt of agony through him the instant it touched his tongue. Somehow he managed not to lose his grip on the vial, keeping it pressed against his lips, until the entire contents had made a fiery progress from his throat to his gut. He convulsed as the pain blossomed, thrashing in the water as it grew, banishing all other sensation, turning his vision grey, then black. He wondered if the pain would kill him before Last Look Jack could send a stream of flame down to boil him as he thrashed. Either way, he knew with absolute certainty he had barely seconds to live. Then it was gone. The pain vanished in an instant. Clay blinked, and the black void filling his eyes cleared. He was still in the water, floating weightlessly below a shimmering surface. The water was cold, but the chill was muted somehow, a distant thing beyond the confines of his body, a body he quickly realized had grown to huge proportions. The view ahead was a melange of color, cool azure shades shot through with smudges of orange and the occasional small flutters of deep red. They see heat rather than light, Ethlyn Drystone had said when she shared memories with him in the ruined amphitheater. Once again, he was seeing the world through the eyes of a drake. He saw that these colors were not so vibrant as those captured by the doomed black all those centuries ago, but any sense of limited vision was more than dispelled by the sound that filled his ears. It was a constant vibrating echo, varying in pitch from one second to the next. It meant little to him, but he could sense an understanding somewhere in his mind. An instinctive knowledge possessed by the one who had captured this memory. The conclusion was as inescapable as it was terrifying. I'm trancing with Last Look Jack. The view shifted as the soundscape changed, a sharp pealing cry cutting through the echo. The shimmering surface above blurred as Clay was propelled through the water, moving with a speed that was beyond any human engine. He could feel the great drake's pulse quicken from a steady, ponderous thrum to a rapid drumbeat as the pealing cry came again. It was plainly a distress call, shot through with panic and terror. They could sense Jack's increasing alarm as they raced through the water, the understanding afforded by the trance enabling him to recognize it as parental concern. Somewhere his child was suffering. Abruptly, the distress call rose to a scream, piercing enough to send a shiver of pain through Clay's mind. Then it was gone, cut off in an instant. Another sensation seeped through his consciousness as the scream faded. Not a sound this time, a scent. It was a smell that would usually stir hunger in the belly of this monstrous predator, but now stirred only despair. Blood. But not prey to be hunted down or a drifting whale carcass to be scavenged. This was the blood of a blue drake. Last look, Jack gave voice to a cry of his own then, a deep-throaty roar of grief that seemed to shake the sea. His speed remained undiminished, however, his massive body coiling with furious energy to propel him on. The scent of blood grew more intense until Clay saw a dark, billowing red fog ahead, cooling to pink as the warmth leached into the water. Jack slowed as he neared the cloud, Clay making out a dark matrix amidst the billowing warmth, a net stretched tight around something large and limp. He could see the dark barbs of several harpoons jutting from the dead blue, a juvenile judging by its size. Blood bloomed with fresh intensity as the net shifted and the body rolled in its snare as it was drawn up towards the surface. Jack's gaze followed the black lines of the hauling ropes, finding two long dark shapes interrupting the surface above. He knew these shapes, knew they brought danger, and normally the sight of them would have caused him to dive for the security of the depths. But not today. He tore the net apart first, triangular, razor-like teeth tearing it to pieces, freeing the slaughtered juvenile inside. Jack paused to regard the slowly descending corpse, falling away into the cold black depths in a shroud of blood. A new memory filled Clay's mind. A small blue struggling free of her mother's womb to coil against her father's massive flanks as he curved his body around them both in a protective embrace, voicing a soft song to soothe her distress. The memory faded, and Clay found Jack's gaze had returned to the two dark shapes above. He roared again, his despair merging with rage. It was a rare emotion for a blue, conserved for the mating season and defending territory from aggressive young males. Now it blooms to unprecedented heights, filling every fiber of Jack's body. Clay felt something give in Jack's mind, a jolting shock that banished his last vestiges of reason. The great blue's roar died. He had no need to voice his rage now. He was rage. The two dark shapes had begun to move, the water on either side of them frothing white and a rhythmic thrum sounding through the ocean. Clay saw soft yellow globes burning in the center of each shape as the blue hunter's engineers stoked them high. Unnerved by the sudden loss of their catch, these sailors had clearly opted not to linger. It wouldn't save them. Jack made for the shape on the left, making a steady but unhurried approach from below. Although the rage still boiled in his mind, his predatory instincts held true, and he knew the wisdom of preserving his energy for the final rush. When he was some 50 yards from the spinning blades of the blue hunter's starboard paddle, he struck. A single thrash of his massive tail shattered the paddle blades into splinters, causing the ship to veer off in a ragged circle, tilting from the force of Jack's blow. Small, dark figures plunged into the water around him, sailors cast from the deck of the stricken vessel. Jack took his time, snapping each struggling figure in half and spitting out the remnants, finding he disliked the taste of these tiny monsters. Their blood was bitter, and their flesh too full of bones. In any case, he was not here to feed. He thrashed his tail again, an explosive release of power that propelled him free of the sea. The ship passed beneath him as his massive body soared over it, sailors gaping up at him in terror, then screaming as he opened his jaws wide and unleashed a torrent of fire. The flames swept the ship from stern to bow, incinerating men and fittings alike, flooding the holds and setting light to anything that would burn. Jack plunged back into the welcoming chill of the ocean, circling the ship as it burned, and killing the charred and barely alive sailors peppering the surrounding waters. A sudden hard vibration pulsed through the sea, as something gave in the ship's vitals, probably a stock of gunpowder from the size of the explosion. Jack watched it break in two and slowly subside into the depths, trailing a dark cloud of blood from its sundered holds. The scent of his kin's blood stoked Jack's rage to even greater heights, Clay feeling the already fragile structure of his mind crumble yet further. The huge blue returned to the surface, raising his head above the waves to see a second ship, several miles to the north, smoke billowing from her funnels and paddles churning as she piled on the steam. It wouldn't save her. The trance fragmented then, Clay experiencing a jolt of pain as the shared memories flitted through his head in a kaleidoscope of wrecked ships and slaughtered sailors. Jack's existence had evidently become an unceasing epic of vengeance, days and nights consumed by the hunt, the endless search for more monsters to kill. He preyed upon whales or giant squid only when his hunger grew into pain. Otherwise, he scoured the oceans for ships, destroying all he could find, but there were always more. Then came a change, a shift in the torrent of rage and tireless hunting. Jack had shunned the company of his own kind for years, ignoring their songs of greeting whenever he passed close to a pack. He knew on some basic level he was no longer one of them. Their songs of bonding and play, or the joy of the hunt, were echoes of something forever lost. Jack had only one song, the rage song. But then came the day he heard something new. Not a plaintive cry drifting through the depths, but a song within his mind. Clay felt another jolt of pain as the song enveloped him, alien and dislocating, and yet dreadfully familiar. The White. The depth of malice was unmistakable, although he found it impossible to fully comprehend the intricacies of the beast's thoughts. But he could feel them, the new sense of purpose seeping into Jack's mind, merging with his rage. Clay could sense the blue struggling against this intrusion. He had a purpose of his own and wanted no other, but the White would not be denied. Soon a fresh torrent of images accompanied the sensation. Another ship viewed through the eyes of another blue. This ship was different, however, a warship judging by its guns. Also, it had no paddles. The Superior, Clay realized, watching a young woman raise a pair of revolvers on the deck below. Lauriabeth, the day the blue attacked us. The image changed as Lauriabeth's bullet struck home, filling it with a red mist that obscured much of what came next, although Clay was able to discern the sudden halt in movement, recalling how he and the Verestian Bloodblessed had used black to hold the blue in place, whilst Captain Heilmore and Lieutenant Steelfine readied the cannon. There was a flash amidst the red mist, and the vision turned instantly to black. The sense of purpose flooding Jack's mind altered, becoming an implacable command, as the image of the Superior reappeared. This time, Clay was able to discern a clear meaning in the White's thoughts. Go south. Kill them. Clay reeled in shock as Jack's memory swirled around him. It sent him after us. It knew where we were going. How? The answer dawned swiftly, accompanied by a tinge of self-reproach at his failure to realize it sooner. Silverpin. The remnant of her consciousness had been living in his head since her betrayal and death beneath the mountain. It followed her scent, forced poor Mad Jack to hunt us down. Another tumble of memories. Jack finding himself part of a pack once more, although the blues he swam with sang no songs. The destruction of Craghurst Station, and his repressed but still evident relish at the sight of so many small monsters burning. Jack chasing the Superior through the channel between the chokes and the shelf, the crushing weight of the huge wedge of displaced ice bearing him down to the depths. So far down, the pressure threatened to crush his mighty body like paper. But he hadn't died. Somehow struggling from under the descending weight and straining damaged muscles as he sought the surface. Soon exhaustion claimed him, leaving him limp and drifting on the current. He would have subsided back into the depths had the pack not found him, coming together to bear him up to the surface and the salvation of the air. Still, he was wounded, needing time and sustenance to heal. The other Blues brought walrus and whale meat, starving themselves so he might eat. Had he still been capable of such things, he would have sung the song of thanks. But they were not truly his pack, and such songs were a distant murmur of who he had once been. He ate, he healed, he waited. And then came the great upsurge of heat from below, fracturing the ice and allowing him to hunt down the monsters that had wounded him. He marshaled his silent pack, sending them out into the newly sundered ice, ranging far until one found his quarry. A new ship, one with no bloom of heat within its hull, but with monsters roving its deck. Jack, though mad, was far from stupid. Having recently suffered at these creatures' hands, he opted for a more cunning approach, sending his pack to bear the brunt of their terrible, unnatural defenses. He watched the sundered, flailing blue bodies fall one by one, clamping down on his rage, forcing patience into his damaged mind. Only when the last of his pack had slipped into the depths, trailing a cloud of gore from the rent in its neck, did he determine to strike. Then a new distraction, a fresh bloom of heat from below accompanied by a great cloud of bubbles, as something rushed towards the surface. Jack had no notion of what this thing was, his vision unable to penetrate the hull to discern any heat sources within. But as it bobbed to the surface, and he watched four monsters clamber out, he knew he had found his first easy prey for a long time. A shallow dive, then an upward rush, was enough to leave the creatures struggling in the water. Jack made for the closest one, grunting in momentary pain, as one of the monsters on the ship cast something at him, small but possessed of enough speed to tear a hole in his scales. But it was a familiar sting. His scales bore the scars of many such irritations, and with the prey so close, he paid it scant heed. The creature struggling in the water below stared up at him, with its tiny bead-like eyes, its claws fumbling for something about its neck. A weapon, perhaps, as if anything so small could threaten him. Clay watched the image of himself struggling in the water freeze and then shatter, leaving him in a formless, multicolored fog. Mists swirled around him, coalescing into dense, vibrantly hued clouds, then breaking apart. Here and there he caught glimpses of firmer memories, blue bodies drifting, dismembered sailors, burning ships. This, then, was the mindscape of Last Look Jack. Beneath the horror, Clay could feel a deep weight of confusion pressing in on his own consciousness, shot through with a growing anger. "You can feel me in here, can't you?" Clay asked, hoping the Drake could discern some meaning in his thoughts. The surrounding mist shimmered, reddish forks of lightning crackling as evidence of Jack's burgeoning rage. "Well, you're stuck with me, for now at least. So let's talk." The lightning flashed again, blood-red tendrils reaching out from the fog to envelop Clay, lacerating him with implacable, utter rejection. He steeled himself against the sensation, fighting off the waves of nausea and confusion that threatened to end the trance. "I know you got good reason to hate me and my kind," Clay persisted as the nausea blossomed into an ache. "But the white..." He choked off as the ache transformed into an abrupt burst of agony deep within his being. The mindscape shimmered again, and he felt the imminent loss of the trance as Jack exerted all his will to cast out the hated intruder. "Bargaining won't work," Clay realized, reasserting his own will, the mindscape flaring bright about him, revealing yet more scenes of death and fire. "He's just too crazy." He struggled to remember everything Ethlyn had said about the effects of drinking heart blood, how it had enabled her to control Lutheron. "No," he reminded himself. "Not control. A mutual understanding," she called it. But how to birth understanding in a mind damaged by so many dire memories? He paused as more of Ethelyn's words came back to him. Drake memory does not die with the individual, but rather accumulates down the bloodline over many generations. He scanned the surrounding chaos, reeling amidst the fury of Jack's continuing efforts to drive him out. Lutheran remembered the white, Clay thought, even though he'd never seen it. Maybe one of Jack's ancestors caught sight of it too. But if so, what then? The experiences of Jack's forebears could hardly be sufficient to restore his sanity. Then something Silverpin's ghost had said popped into his head. A small nugget of insight that reminded him she had been more than just the White's vassal.
What are people anyway, if not just a collection of memories?
Clay summoned all his will, then unleashed it in an instant, blasting away the surrounding fog. He felt Jack shudder under the impact, his rage momentarily quelled by the burst of mental strength. Must be the heart blood, Clay decided. Gives extra power in the trance. He focused on the remnants of memory now drifting around him in an otherwise black void, finding fragmentary glimpses of yet more bloody, flame-soaked vengeance. Reaching out to one, a tight ball containing a vision of the attack on Crackhurst Station, he exerted his will again, forcing it into a tiny bead before crushing it to fragments. He moved on, roaming Jack's mindscape and crushing all the traumatic memories he could find. Jack fought him, red lightning lashing out again and again, but with diminishing force as his memories died. Clay couldn't get them all. Some were too formless to be captured, and others just snippets of barely remembered carnage. Here and there he encountered odd moments of serenity or even joy, mainly concerning Jack's life before the raging insanity of his vengeance. These Clay left alone, though they were few and far between, and certainly not enough to return this beast to sanity. Confusion reigned in the mindscape as Clay crushed the last of the major horrors, the death throes of a blue hunter Jack had tormented for days, rearing up every few hours to roast a sailor or two, before diving down to let the survivors ponder their impending fate. Humans, it seemed, had taught him the pleasures of sadism. All Jack's resistance seeped away as the memory crumbled, leaving only the vaguest sense of who or what he was. I could just leave now, Clay knew. End the trance and let him wander the ice, mind broken forever. But what use was there in that? Let's see what your ancestors left you. Clay reached into his own memory, summoning the most vibrant image of the white he could find. That final glimpse beneath the mountain as it raged amongst the swarm of its newly hatched kin. Remind you of anything? He asked Jack, who failed to provide an answer. Clay expanded the memory, filling the surrounding void with it. Come on, must be something in here. Something buried deep. He saw it then, a faint glimmer in the void. Clay exerted his will, drawing the glimmer closer, feeding it with the memory of the white, so that it grew, blossoming out into a view of a broad sky above a choppy gray sea. Blues churned the water on all sides, long bodies knifing through the waves, whilst above a battle raged. Drakes, red and black, wheeled below grey-white clouds, casting flames at each other, or locking together in an ugly tangle of thrashing tails and snapping jaws. Drakes plummeted into the sea with grim regularity, either sinking immediately or struggling on the surface as their wounds leaked into the water. The blues ignored the stricken reds and swarmed over the blacks with streaming fire and gnashing teeth. They could sense the blankness of the mind that had captured this memory, largely devoid of thought and filled only with a purpose not its own. Kill them, it commanded, the image shifting as the owner of these ancient eyes fixated on a maimed black nearby, trying vainly to take to the air with one undamaged wing. Kill them, oh! Then it was gone. The purpose, the command, vanished from the blue's mind, and allowing an inrush of sensation. The blue halted its charge as the urge towards combat faded, instead circling the struggling black, casting out curious songs of greeting as its strength gave out and it slipped beneath the waves. The blue cast its gaze to the sky, seeing that the warring factions had now separated. The reds formed into a loose pack and striking out towards the northeast, whilst the surviving blacks made for the west. Clay managed to make out the dim but unmistakable figure of a human rider on at least one of the blacks, before they slipped into the cloud and were gone from view. The end of the war, he realized. The first one. The white rose before and they defeated it, somehow. He pushed the question aside, for it was clear the answer didn't lie in the mind of this long-dead blue. He sorted through the memories, finding it a far simpler creature than Jack, its songs joyous and possessing only the smallest tinge of rage. A simple soul, Clay thought, biting down a pang of guilt. Not sure you're gonna like your new home. The chill gripped him like a steel fist the moment the trance faded, forcing out a gasp that would have been a yell if he had the breath for it. He bobbed in the swell as the huge blue sank back into the water, retreating a short distance to hover close by, its head barely above the surface with one wide eye fixed on Clay. He could feel its song thrumming the water, rich in distress. It seemed the trance had left him with an understanding of blue song. A splash drew Clay's gaze to the left, where he found Chris and Lauriabeth struggling to keep Lieutenant Sigurd's head above the water. The Corventine's face was bleached white, and his one good eye dimmed. A series of splashes came from the right, accompanied by the overlapping whine of multiple bullets and the faint crackle of rifle fire. The distress song from the blue that had been Last Look Jack rose in pitch as he recoiled from the hail of projectiles, sinking lower in the water.
Stop!
Clay shouted, twisting about to face the ship, his words choked off behind chattering teeth. He could see a row of armed men at the rail, Uncle Braddon among them. Preacher stood tall in the crow's nest, rifle at his shoulder. More worryingly, Lieutenant Steelfine and Captain Heilmore were frantically trying to maneuver a cannon into place. The gun had clearly suffered some damage, its barrel thickly wrapped with rope, making Clay wonder if the act of firing it would pose more of a danger to the crew than to Jack. Clay dragged a deep breath into his lungs and called out with all the volume he could muster.
Stop fucking shooting!
The words echoed across the intervening water, heralding a pause in activity on the ship. Clay saw Heilmore straighten from the cannon in evident confusion.
Clay!
Lauriabeth gasped, and he turned to see Sigurd slip from her grasp. Clay swam towards them and dived, managing to grab hold of the Corventine's jacket before he sank beyond reach, dragging him back to the surface. Chris and Lauriabeth closed in, the three of them kicking frantically to bear Sigurd up. A series of shouts came from the ship, Clay craning his neck to see Heilmore directing a party to lower a boat into the water.
Won't be enough time,
Clay knew with a grim certainty, turning back to regard Sigurd's bloodless complexion. It was also clear that Chris and Lauriabeth were fast approaching their limits, as the water's chill sapped their reserves of strength. He turned to where the huge blue still loitered 20 yards off, casting out his plaintive distress call. Clay concentrated, summoning the memory of the remade mindscape he had crafted in the beast's head, filling it with a distress call of his own. The blue's response was surprising in its immediacy, propelling himself towards them with a single swish of his tail before rolling over to present his back spines.
Grab on!
Clay told the others, reaching out to grasp the nearest spine. He took a firm hold of both the bony protrusion and Sigurd's jacket before hauling himself closer. Chris was obliged to help Lauriabeth, who seemed to have lost the ability to raise her arms above the water, the older woman wrapping an arm around her chest and pulling them both towards the Drake's huge flank. Once they had all taken hold, The blue rolled again, lifting them clear of the water's deathly chill, before bearing them towards the ship. As they surged through the water, Clay caught sight of something bobbing on the surface. His pack, kept afloat by the bulbous cargo it held.
Slow,
he told the blue, who obligingly reduced his speed, allowing Clay to reach out and reclaim the pack.
Don't worry, young'un,
he silently comforted the egg. Carried you way too far to leave you behind now. He looked up as the deck of the ship loomed above, finding a row of gaunt and stunned faces. Uncle Braddon was the sole exception. Any astonishment he may have felt was clearly drowned by the joy of seeing his daughter again.
Got yourself a new pet, I see,
Braddon said, his heavy beard parting in a broad smile.
More like a new friend, Clay replied. That there's last look, Jack,
one of the crew said. It took Clay a moment to recognize Scrimshine's face under the fellow's scraggly beard. The former smuggler clutched a rifle in his bony hands as he stared down at the blue's massive body, eyes large in his emaciated skull.
We should kill it, Skipper,
he went on, turning to Heilmore with shrill insistence.
Kill it right now, I says!
Hearing the murmur of agreement from the other crewmen, and noting the severe doubt on the captain's face, Clay said,
That name don't fit him no more. This.
Clay leaned forward to pat the broad, scaly space between the blue's eyes.
This is old Jack now, and he's gonna get us out of here.
Chapter 2. Lizanne. Nothing at all. Sophia Griffin shook her head, loose red tresses playing over the pale skin of her forehead. She had maintained a largely silent and downcast demeanor since the profitable venture sailed from Corvus, her inexperienced mind no doubt crowded with the horrors she had witnessed during the capital's fall. However, now she seemed on the verge of some form of mental collapse, her husband reaching out to clasp her hands as they trembled in her lap.
Nothing,
she said, eyes flashing at Lizanne in resentful accusation, as if this turn of events was somehow her contrivance.
Pharos is silent. That has never happened before.
You have an alternative point of contact, do you not?
Director Thriftmore asked, the inevitable brandy glass in hand.
In Sonora?
Sophia's head moved in a sharp, nervous nod.
A scheduled emergency contact in Northern Fleet headquarters. I tranced with them less than an hour ago. They've had no contact with Pharos since yesterday, nor with any fleet units in the harbor. Blood?
She faltered, closing her eyes to stem an upsurge of tears before continuing, forcing the words out.
Blood-burning patrol craft have been dispatched, but it will be several days before they report in.
Silence reigned in the wardroom, as each person present digested the news, and the director took the opportunity to refresh his glass. It was Captain Verix who broke the silence, his only evident sign of discomfort, a slight twitch in the impressive grey whiskers that covered the lower regions of his craggy face.
My orders remain clear,
he said in a gruff tone that said much of his ability to convey a sense of unflappable authority, even in times of great uncertainty.
The profitable venture is to transport Director Thriftmore and Miss Lethbridge to Pharos, following the completion of their mission to the Corvantine Empire. I intend to fulfill these orders. Trance or not.
Pharos has fallen,
Lizanne told Verix, the certainty in her own voice more than a match for his. Her imagination had seen fit to crowd her mind with a plethora of dreadful visions concerning the likely fates of those she had left behind to pursue her Corvantine adventures.
Aunt Pendilla, Jemiah, Father, Tekela.
Guilt and self-reproach roiled in her breast as she met the captain's gaze.
I should have gotten them on the first ship to a Mandalorian port.
But she had no notion the White would be able to strike so far north so quickly, and Pharos was one of the most well-defended ports in the world.
"My orders," Captain Verex began, but she cut him off.
"Your orders came from a board which is now most likely dead or enslaved."
The harshness in her tone drew a frightened sob from Sophia, but Lizanne ignored her, stepping closer to Verex to emphasize her point.
"We should hope for the former, since I do not relish the prospect of our adversary learning their secrets, as it surely has if it captured any alive."
Verex blinked, his gaze switching back and forth between her and Thriftmore.
"In that event," he said, and Lizanne could see the distasteful curl of his lips beneath the whiskers, "Director Thriftmore would appear to be the sole remaining authority."
Thriftmore's brandy glass halted its progress towards his mouth, as all eyes turned to him in expectation. Besides Lizanne, Verex and the Griffins, the ship's senior officers were also present at this conference. It was clear to Lizanne that Thriftmore didn't enjoy the scrutiny of such a sizable audience.
He
said, lowering his brandy glass and inclining his head at Verex.
"I believe in times of crisis, it is best to defer to military judgment."
He coughed and forced a tight smile in Verek's direction.
"Your advice, Captain?"
A derisive scowl momentarily creased the captain's forehead before he turned his gaze away from Thriftmore to address his officers.
"It's highly likely the Profitable is closer to Pharos than any Protectorate patrol craft. Our first duty must be to the Syndicate. We will approach in full battle order and endeavor to carry out a fulsome reconnaissance of the Tyrell Islands. Once the current situation at Pharos has been established, Mrs. Griffin will convey the intelligence to Northern Fleet Headquarters with a request for further orders."
Had Lizanne still held to her operating parameters as an exceptional initiatives agent, she would have protested, perhaps even leveraged her status, to force the captain to sail immediately for northern waters. She had endured weeks in the stink and danger of Skorazen, the imperial prison city, to free the tinkerer and the precious knowledge he possessed. Then there had been the great tribulation of the revolution and the fall of Corvus, all the time wondering when the Electress would choose to settle her score. All just to get the tinkerer aboard this ship, making for Pharos threatened to rob them of whatever advantage his secrets might hold. But the guilt still roiled, and she found she had to know what had befallen those she had left to face the storm. So she stood and said nothing as Captain Verex reeled off a string of orders to his officers.
"In the meantime, Miss Lethbridge,"
Verex said to Lizanne when the room had cleared,
"it might be best if you compiled whatever report Exceptional Initiatives is expecting of you. It can be communicated by Mrs. Griffin before we close on the Isles."
"Sadly,"
Lizanne replied with a sigh, making for the wardroom door and sparing a glance at Thriftmore, now busily refreshing his brandy glass,
"it's not quite that easy."
"You promised security,"
Tinkerer said in his usual colorless voice. He glanced around at the Spartan cabin he had been given, and Lizanne wondered if he was pining for his books and diagrams.
"This isn't it."
"I promised escape from Skorazen," Lizanne returned. "And I delivered. My end of the bargain is fulfilled."
She held out a vial of blue.
"Now it's time for yours, sir."
"Bargains can be renegotiated,"
he said, making no move to take the vial.
"Especially when the value of the item under negotiation has increased."
He fell to an abrupt silence as Lizanne took a revolver from the pocket of her skirt and leveled it at his head. The cylinder clicked as she cocked the hammer.
"I am in no mood for your particular manners, sir,"
she informed him in slow, unmistakable tones.
"Up until this point, have I given you any reason to doubt my word?"
His face remained impassive as he replied with a fractional shake of his head.
"Good.
Then trust me when I say that you will either surrender your secrets now, or I will decorate this cabin with your brains.
She held out the vial once more.
As I say, I am in no mood.
He lifted one of his deft, slim-fingered hands and plucked the vial from her grasp.
One chance won't be enough,
he cautioned her, removing the stopper and drinking half the contents.
The amount of information is considerable and complex.
Then it's all the more important that we make a start,
Lizanne replied, retrieving the vial and drinking the remaining product. She lowered the revolver and they matched stares. For several seconds, nothing happened, the expected trance failing to materialize. It occurred to her that Tinkerer's singular personality might prohibit any trance connection. It required some form of emotional bond after all, however slight. But she recalled that he had made at least one friend in Skorazin, although even the unfortunately deceased Melina felt obliged to punch him in the face at one point.
Perhaps a stronger dose, she began, reaching for her wallet.
But then Tinkerer blinked and the cabin disappeared. The vision that greeted Lizanne was amazingly detailed, possessing a clarity and exactitude she had never before seen in a blue trance. Even the most vivid memory was inevitably altered by the mind that recalled it, insignificant elements rendered vague or omitted completely. For Tinkerer, however, it appeared nothing was insignificant. Every cobble of the street beneath their feet caught the dim sunlight peeking through the slowly drifting grey clouds above. Every brick, timber and pane of glass that formed the surrounding houses was fully present, as was the tinge of horse dung that combined with wood smoke and a faint tang of salt to stain the air. A port, Lizanne decided, trying vainly to conceal the sense of wonder that leached from her mind as she surveyed her new surroundings. She spied a tall tower poking above the rooftops to the south, a spire that closely resembled the oracular temple in the Moorsvale Park, where she had hidden with Tekela and Major Arberus. Thoughts of Tekela immediately quelled her amazement. We have a task, she reminded herself, turning to Tinkerer who stood a few feet away, expression as blank as ever.
Where is this? She asked him.
Valazin, he replied. I was conceived here.
She had never been to this city, but knew Valazin to be the largest port on the Corventine Empire's northeastern coast. Once an independent city-state, it had been incorporated into the Empire some 6 centuries ago. She remembered from her many briefings on Corventine politics that the port had been the scene of some of the worst outrages of the Revolutionary Wars. The inhabitants had unwisely taken advantage of the chaos to resurrect archaic notions of reclaiming long-lost sovereignty. A series of brief battles and prolonged massacres, undertaken by the three now extinct legions of the Household Division, had put paid to any such illusions. Judging by the fact that many of the houses in sight were of recent construction, and the numerous imperial posters pasted onto the walls, she deduced they were viewing Valazin some years after its subjugation. Tinkerer strode across the street and halted before a shop window decorated with the words, Escavin Toys and Trinkets, finest toy makers in Valazin since 1209. Lizanne moved to his side, peering through the glass at the interior, where a diminutive figure could be seen at a workbench. Peering closer, she saw that it was a woman, perhaps 20 years old. Engaged in wrapping a small wooden box with brown paper. Lizanne took note of the woman's bulging belly.
Your mother?
Yes. This was my family's shop. Grandfather taught mother how to make the toys, and father took the shop over when he died.
If she had expected to see some flicker of affection as he gazed upon his mother, she was to be disappointed. His face retained its usual impassivity. As the woman finished wrapping the box, tying the covering in place with a length of string and a small knot. The woman placed the box under her arm and exited the shop, the bell above the door jingling as she stepped out onto the cobbles. Lisanne was struck by the resemblance to Tinkerer, her pale features a feminine.